Hello, and welcome to our program, Senior Living, brought to you by Al Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During this next half hour, I'm reading articles from the AARP Bulletin here on Al Radio. And the first one is under the Your Health section, Health Research Safety Tips, advice for intrepid internet sleuths looking for credible medical websites, studies, and symptom finders. By Hallie Levine. Cardiologist Barbara Roberts, 78, volunteered with the Rhode Island Medical Reserve Corps during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccinated many hundreds of people. So she was disturbed to learn last April that her cousin's wife, who was also in her 70s, was hospitalized and on a ventilator after contracting COVID. I didn't realize she hadn't been vaccinated, but her husband told me that they'd done their research online and decided against it, Roberts recalls. I was horrified because there's so much health misinformation on the web. People tend to believe anything that supports their own biases, in this case, that it would be dangerous to get the vaccine. When the woman died, it made me both very angry and very sad, Roberts says. It was totally preventable. Stories like Roberts are too common these days as more and more of us have turned to the internet to research our own medical conditions and concerns. According to a 2021 survey, almost 60% of Americans go online to get medical questions answered, and 4 in 5 of us research our medical recommendations online after a doctor appointment. Although there are many benefits to doing your own health research, there's a dark side too. Some people just end up believing everything they read, or they become so cynical about the health information blasted at them online that they may begin to generally distrust the medical profession, says healthcare journalist Gary Switzer, founder of the former Health News Review website. The problem could get even worse after the introduction of artificial intelligence-driven text-generating tools called chatbots. When you ask a chatbot a question, it pulls information from everywhere online to create an amalgam of data, news, and opinion, taking from both traditional and unknown sources. Online publishers use these bots to generate content, including in the health space. We asked some of the nation's top epidemiologists for the fundamentals of doing your own health research. From how to find the most credible sites to evaluating the best symptom checker. We chose 3 common scenarios you may face at some point to help you find the information you need safely. Research trigger number 1. Your doctor just gave you an alarming diagnosis. If you've been told you could have a particular health condition, your first impulse may be to simply type it into a search engine. That is probably not the best move, cautions Alice Pomodoro, MD, a retired professor of geriatrics at Florida State University. You might get an ad that looks official or other information that's not reputable, she explains. Look for a sponsored tag. It means an organization has paid big dollars to show up at the top of searches related to that topic. Rather than type your diagnosis into a search engine, Pomodoro recommends that you go to one of the following sites and search for your diagnosed condition within it: the National Institute on Aging, the American Geriatric Society, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, National Institutes of Health, American Academy of Family Physicians, the Mayo Clinic. Each of these sites includes a health information page where you can search topics from A to Z to find your specific concern. Any health website sponsored by a federal government agency should provide the most up-to-date, reliable information. Those sites will end in .gov. You can also visit usa.gov for a list of federal websites. Other excellent options are well-known medical schools, whose sites tend to end in .edu, as well as large professional organizations. But it's important to not just automatically assume that because a website ends in .org that it's legitimate, cautions Robert Schmerling, MD, a senior faculty editor at Harvard Health Publishing and member of the Faculty of Medicine. Though .org usually indicates a nonprofit, it may be an advocacy group that's pushing its own unresearched agenda. Research trigger number two. You see a startling health news story or hear a surprising medical claim. If a headline about a health discovery sounds too good to be true, it usually is. It's clickbait. The news is based on a new study. But there are no links to the study and few or no mentions of an author. That's a red flag, says Jennifer Manganello, a professor of health policy, management, and behavior at the School of Public Health at University at Albany. If there is a link to the study, look for this information. Who conducted the study? Ideally, Manganello says, a study authors are affiliated with a large research institution such as the medical school of a highly respected university. Can the scientific evidence be trusted? The gold standard is usually a randomized control trial where people who received a specific treatment are compared with a control group that didn't. Scientists also use good but less reliable observational studies. For instance, such a study may find that people who meditate regularly are less likely to have a heart attack, but the results may be due to their healthier lifestyles in general. Who was involved with the study and how many participated? Well-done studies often involve hundreds, even thousands of participants, Manganello says. Notice who they were and if their cases apply to yours. Is it peer-reviewed? Trust only studies published in medical journals. They typically have strict criteria for inclusion. Just recently, I stumbled upon a so-called scientist on Twitter, says Marnie White, professor of social and behavioral sciences at the Yale School of Public Health in New Haven, Connecticut. The person posted a study with a preposterous claim. White says, I soon found out that this individual hadn't been employed in their field for many years, and they were citing an unpublished paper. But I could see how convincing this person might be. When reading a study, your initial step is to look at the abstract. This short intro can help you with the study, with what the study's about and its main findings. Research trigger number three. You have something strange going on with your body. First off, try not to self-diagnose. Second, a 2021 study suggests that symptom decoding tools are accurate only about half the time. Manganello recommends that you stick with symptom checkers that are part of a hospital or medical center website. There are several good quality for-profit sites that provide symptom analysis as well. Of course, these checkers should be just one source of information. If you can't resist searching your symptoms online, here are some things to do to keep in mind, Pomodoro says. Don't go straight to the sources at the top of your search results, since those may be paid advertisements. Also, stay away from forums, review sites, or social media, since they can be alarmist. Start with a nationally known health systems or organization's website, though you will still need to get that strange rash checked by your doctor. You can take a picture of it with your phone and send it to their office, Pomodoro suggests, but she stresses that you should send your information or photo via your doctor's patient portal. If you send it by email or another way, your medical or personal information may not be safe. The next article from the AARP Bulletin is in the Your Health section. Think on your feet. To help improve your brain's health, lace up your sneakers and hit the road. In early 2020, COVID-19 brought an end to my workouts at the gym. I was self-employed and recently widowed, and my new normal felt like solitary confinement. Then one morning, I made a break for it and went for a walk. I did it again the next day, and then the next. Soon, my new daily habit began to make me feel happier and my mind sharper, both of which I could only credit to my daily treks. Curious about what was occurring, I did some research. It turns out there's a mountain of scientific evidence that shows walking, especially walking outdoors, is powerful medicine for your brain. Here's what the science shows. Walking may help you grow new brain cells. Moderately paced walks stimulate the release of a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, that is key to the survival of existing brain neurons and the generation of new ones. Perhaps the most exciting finding is that aerobic forms of exercise, including walking, likely help facilitate the growth of new neurons, says Patrick Smith, associate professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Walking may boost your creativity. Walking increases the flow of oxygen and nutrients to the brain, which can open the gates to enhanced creativity. The brain uses about 3 times as much oxygen for healthy neuron function as muscles do, and is extremely sensitive to decreases in oxygen levels. According to Advanced Neurotherapy, a neurofeedback wellness clinic in Needham, Massachusetts, creativity is a cognitive skill that is part of problem solving. Studies show that the simple act of getting up from your desk and taking a short walk can help trigger ideas. A Stanford University study found creative output increases 60% when participants were walking, even on a treadmill facing a blank wall. Walking may enhance your mood. When you walk, increased blood flow to the brain initiates a cascade of changes, says Marie Pasinski, MD, assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. A cocktail of feel-good neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, endorphins, is released. 42% of American adults suffer a vitamin D deficiency. Our bodies manufacture vitamin D when exposed to sunlight, furthering the production of serotonin, a hormone benefiting memory and mood. Even on a cloudy day, exposure to light elevates the mood, says John Brady, MD, associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Walking may reduce the risk of cognitive decline. Participants who walked more than 4,000 steps per day had healthier brain tissue in the area responsible for memory, learning, and cognitive function than those who did not, one study found. That brain region, called the hippocampus, typically begins to shrink in late adulthood, leading not only to impaired memory but also an increased risk of dementia. The research revealed that aerobic exercises increases the size of the hippocampus. Walking may decrease brain-damaging stress. Repeated exposure to stressful situations impairs memory, attention, and cognitive flexibility. Walking in nature has been shown to be particularly effective at reducing stress levels. The impact of being outdoors may have to do with optic flow, the perception that objects are moving past us as we walk, which quiets the circuits responsible for stress, says Andrew Huberman, a neuroscientist in the Department of Neurobiology at Stanford Medicine. Self-generated optic flow, by walking, running, or cycling, shifts the brain into a state of relaxation that's not seen when you're stationary, he says. Scientists have seen walking reduce levels of cortisol, which surges during fight-or-flight situations. Elevated cortisol levels may damage cognition and contribute to Alzheimer's disease, according to a 2019 review of studies in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience. Just a 20-minute walk has been shown to reduce stress. The next article from AARP Bulletin is Fraud Watch: AI Gives Scammers a Scary New Tool, by Chris Morris. Artificial intelligence has opened a new door for scammers, making it easy to replicate almost anyone's voice from a brief audio sample. That has made frauds such as the grandparent scam, built around a fake phone call supposedly from a grandchild, frighteningly effective, experts say. All crooks need is a short sample of a person's voice, which can often be found on social media posts. From there, they run it through sophisticated but readily available and cheap software to create a digital duplicate, which they can program to say whatever words they want to use. The state-of-the-art AI can generate realistic images and voices and is used as a tool of impersonation in scams targeting older Americans, says Siwei Liu, a professor of computer science at the University at Buffalo, State University of New York, and an expert in digital media forensics. The scammers rely on the familiarity of the voices. Last year, consumers lost $2.6 billion to this sort of fraud, up from $2.4 billion in 2021. The boom in AI scams is likely just beginning, says AARP anti-fraud expert Mark Fetterhoff. It may be possible scammers are using AI to clone voices as part of romance scams, celebrity imposter scams, and tech support scams, he says. Lou runs a project called DART, Deception Awareness and Resilience Training, which helps older Americans recognize scams via a mobile game. He warns that if the scammers fool you, there's often no way to get the money back. If you received a call seemingly from someone close to you asking for money, there are steps the Federal Trade Commission suggests you take to protect yourself. Slow things down. These calls typically move fast. If someone you know seems to be calling you for money unexpectedly, tell them you'll call back, then find the number from a trusted source. Resist pressure. If the caller stresses the urgency of their need, that's almost always a fraud signal. No legit organization demands money within hours. Don't be goaded or guilted into sending money until you've verified what's going on. Listen for red flags. If the caller says that it's important to keep things secret, that's a strong indicator you're being scammed. The bad news? More sophisticated scams are ahead. The next round of robot calls will be made from scripts created from AI chatbots converted to a person's voice, Lou warns. Technology could also be used to create video calls with the grandkid's face. Ask the fraud team. My older sister lives alone and had some workers knock on her door claiming her roof needed fixing. She paid cash up front for the first half of the job. The crew never showed up again. Was she targeted for this scam? This is a common fraud that recurs every year with warm weather. She may need to have a reputable contractor look at the roof to ensure no damage was done. Have her report this situation to local law enforcement. She is likely not the only victim in the area. My daughter found Taylor Swift tickets for a great price on social media. They asked her to pay by Venmo, and then they would transfer the tickets, should she? Many criminals will post too-good-to-be-true offers for concert tickets online and ask to be paid by a peer-to-peer payment app such as Venmo, Cash App, or Zelle. Those payments are virtually untraceable, and actually getting what you paid for is a long shot. For greater peace of mind when looking for event tickets, use an authorized ticket reseller that takes credit cards. The next article from AARP Bulletin is the Your Life section. Visiting Yankee Stadium with Dad. It was the first major league game I can recall. Over six decades later, it remains one of my most memorable. By Bob Costas. To appreciate what follows, a boomer's first vivid recollection of a visit to a major league baseball park, it's important to understand that post-World War II and well into the 60s, the vast majority of ball games were not televised, and those that were came to us in black and white. We experienced the game primarily through the word pictures painted by classic radio broadcasters. The grainy TV images, no replays, no multiple angles or reaction shots, actually conveyed less of what it might feel like to be at the ballpark than a great radio announcer could. What was missing, most of all, were the colors. Many fans of a certain age have likened walking for the first time up to the tunnel leading to their seats to the moment when Dorothy is transported from black and white Kansas to Technicolor Oz, like entering a different, and for a kid, enchanting world. The emerald green grass, the burnt orange of the infield dirt, and the outfield warning track, the pristine white baselines and outlines of the batter's box were beyond striking. In my case, I was seven, and all this flashed before my eyes on a September Saturday in 1959 at Yankee Stadium. Add then to the thrilling sensory overload the sheer enormity of the place, 461 feet to dead center, 457 to left center, 402 to straightaway left, the triple-decker grandstand topped off by the distinctive latticework facade. To me, it felt like a baseball cathedral. After all, the house that Ruth built was then the most awe-inspiring fabled ballpark. Still, in their own way, millions of kids had essentially the same rush of wonder and delight entering Cincinnati's Crosley Field, Detroit's Tiger Stadium, St. Louis's Sportsman's Park, Brooklyn's Ebbets Field, and the grand dames of the American and National Leagues, Fenway in Boston and Wrigley in Chicago. The game was uneventful, Orioles 7, Yanks 2. Mickey Mantle didn't play, which temporarily dampened my spirits, but not for long. It all comes back to me decades later. The seats in the lower left field stands, $1.50, the hot dogs, $0.25, the scorecard, $0.10, and my dad teaching me how to keep score. No, Bobby, the third baseman is 5, the shortstop is 6, a strikeout is a K. Why, Dad? The swirl of cigar smoke, the men in white shirts and fedoras, the vendors' cries of beer here, ice cold beer. My Mantle model glove at the ready in case a 450-foot homer somehow found us. Was there any better place than this? Not to me, not then. And then somehow it got better. Back in the day, after the game, fans exited the ballpark by way of the field. That's right, they opened the gates and let you walk on the warning track around the circumference of Yankee Stadium. Holding my dad's hand, I peered into the Yankee dugout, empty now except for a few scattered towels and 2 bats still in the rack. Mickey Mantle sat there, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, and I am this close? I may actually have been trembling. A brief moment of disillusionment came when we arrived at the 407-foot sign painted in white on the wall in front of the right field bleachers. I was confronted by sacrilege. Dopey scribblings defacing the numerals. Tony loves Angela. F the White Sox. Tom was here 5/13/58. What manner of heathen or heretic would deface a shrine in this way? These were irredeemable souls who would apply graffiti to the Sistine Chapel, which I am sure would have been my next thought if, in 1959, I had any idea what the Sistine Chapel was. Still, to me, we were standing on the most hallowed ground imaginable, which brings me to what happened next. These days, Yankee Stadium's Monument Park is located beyond the centered field fence, and it houses numerous monuments and plaques honoring generations of Yankee greats. But then there were only the 3 monuments, and those 3 were on the field itself, on the warning track just in front of the flagpole and the 461-foot sign. They stood there in solemn tribute to Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and their manager, Miller Huggins. All were truly immortal. All were long since gone. Now I ask you, what would a baseball-worshipping 7-year-old kid think about this? I was convinced they were buried there, that this was the sacred Yankee burial ground, and that the monuments were their headstones. Worse yet, it occurred to me that someday Joe DiMaggio would join them there in truly dead center field, and eventually, inevitably, so too would Mantle, my favorite player. The enormity of this realization was too much. I began to cry. My father tried to assure me that, yes, these men had died, but they were buried elsewhere. I was having none of it. The occasion called for reverence. So, choking back tears, I respectfully touched all 3 monuments and whispered what passed for a prayer for each. As we continued along the warning track toward the left field bullpen gate, which opened onto the street where we would catch the subway out of the Bronx, my dad tried to change my mood. He hoisted me up over his head, got me giggling, and placed me on his shoulders as we bobbed along toward the exit. I recall that he smelled like Old Spice, the era's fragrance of choice for American men. Soon enough, I had made my peace with the place of Ruth, Gehrig, and Huggins in the beyond. The Yankees' loss didn't bother me either. Just being at Yankee Stadium in living color for the first time was beyond exciting. Dad took me to many games after that, but he died just 11 years later. He was 42. I was 18. Of all the playoff and World Series games I have been lucky enough to broadcast, many with my own son at my side, I was never able to take my dad along to a single one. Maybe that's why, among the thousands of games I have attended, that September day in 1959 will always be among those I recall most fondly. Bob Costas, 71, is a legendary sportscaster who has won 29 Emmys. He worked at NBC Sports from 1980 through 2018, covering everything from the World Series to the Olympics. The next article from AARP Bulletin is Q&A, Annette Gordon-Reed. This country was born in turmoil and conflict. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Annette Gordon-Reed, 64, on researching and living America's history. You won a Pulitzer Prize for your book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. How did you become interested in Thomas Jefferson and the Hemingses?
My third grade classroom had a little library with a set of biographies of famous people like George Washington Carver, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Dolly Madison. Jefferson was the most interesting to me because he loved to read, and I loved to read, and he wrote the Declaration of Independence, but he was a slave owner. This was the first I had read about slavery. It was a child's biography, so it was not very sophisticated, but it sparked an interest.
What do you want people to understand about the Hemingses beyond that Jefferson fathered Sally Hemings' children?
They were not just enslaved people. That was the institution that bound their lives, but they were mothers, fathers, cousins, sisters, aunts, friends. They had different personalities, different ways of going through the world. It's just that their opportunities were severely circumscribed because of slavery. So I want them to be seen as individual human beings.
Do you think history needs to change the view of Thomas Jefferson?
I understand how people would not want to have something named for Jefferson, but I think we have to grapple with him because he embodies to me the contradictions of this country, the good things and the bad things. Members of the founding generation, of which Jefferson was one, have to be a part of our conversation. If there are statues and things named for them, it's an opportunity to talk about the way this country was born. And it wasn't born in just a good and wonderful way. It was born in turmoil and conflict. I just don't think we can excise the parts of history that are less than favorable because they helped make us who we are today.
Your latest book, On Juneteenth, is about that holiday's history. Can you explain?
It commemorates the day on June 19, 1865, when Major General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, and announced that slavery was no longer legal in Texas. It's a holiday that black Texans have been celebrating since 1865, and when they moved to other places, they took the holiday with them. What does it mean for your Texas family?
I recall my great-grandmother telling me how important the day was in our family. I got the impression they had celebrated the holiday for as long as she could remember. She was born in the 1880s.
Does anything make you optimistic about race relations right now?
Young people. They are more sensitive to the issues involving race and the history of this country. Their generation has grown up thinking that there has been a problem, and it's a problem that we have to deal with. There are some people who want to shut down talking about history, but I think young people seem to be resisting that.
What's your next project?
I'm doing a second volume of the Hemings family story, during and in the aftermath of the Civil War, and I'm thinking about writing something about Galveston, which was the seat of a lot of black progress, and I'd like to find out more about it.
In 1964, you were the first child in your hometown of Conroe, Texas, to integrate a segregated school. What was that like?
It was intense. I didn't have the sophistication to know all the ways in which it was a big deal, but I did know it was a big deal for a black child to go to a white school. I grew up where we had separate waiting rooms at the doctor's office, and when we went to the movies, black people sat in the balcony. I understood I was breaking a barrier.
A new school in Conroe was recently named in your honor, Annette Gordon Reed Elementary School. What would your parents have thought?
When they grew up in the South, the only black people who got their names on things were Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass, people of that nature. I think they would have marveled at how far the area had come to be able to do that.
You have been listening to Senior Living on Al Radio. You can listen to Al Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.alradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon saying goodbye from Al Radio.